welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 145. Your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
And me, Ravi Abbott.
And it is Play Expo weekend.
Oh, I'm loving it. Yes, Blackpool is amazing. You know, there's so many cool things there. Like, I have not told anybody on the podcast this, but I'm a Star Trek geek. And they actually have Star Trek the Exhibition, which is like a full recreation of the bridge and everything. So I'm going to go and check that before going to Play Expo.
Is that why you're going a bit early?
Yeah, day early just to get my Star Trek in.
See, I've never been a big Star Trek fan, but I think only because my mum is a massive Trekkie. And when I was a kid, I was like, oh, you're watching this again. I just want to watch Ghostbusters or something. So
yeah,
that kind of put me off Star Trek, I think.
Yeah, I've even got my own little badge and everything. It's going to be so geeky.
And the pointy ears, I can see. Yeah. So, it is Play Expo weekend. I know we often get a lot of listeners who maybe discover us because of all the panels that we do at Play Expo. So if you are a new listener to the show, welcome on board. You've got 144 episodes to catch you up on.
Yeah, and most of them are interview. I'd say probably about 140 episodes. Yeah. So we always cover the news in the first half, and then in the second half we get a guest on. And what a guest we have today. It's fantastic.
Well, I imagine there will be a lot of people listening who like Sega, because, I mean, at Play Expo this weekend, if you're coming along to Blackpool, we are going to have a celebration of, weirdly, one of Sega's least selling consoles, but also probably the most beloved of all the systems.
Oh, yes, the Dreamcast. And I absolutely love that system. It was really cool, and it was late on in Sega's life, but I think it was a great last breath.
Yeah, well, that was the Dreamcast we're talking about, which celebrates its 20th anniversary this year. It was 20 years ago that it came out in Japan. And this weekend in Blackpool, we're going to be joined by probably the most famous YouTuber who covers Dreamcast, and that is Adam Korolek, who are actually flying in from America to join us on a couple of panels this weekend. And also we're going to have loads of others. Jeff Minter.
Oh, I'm really excited about this.
Going to have a big YouTubers panel as well. Traders are going to be there, big pinball area. Of course, this weekend is Halloween weekend as well. So I imagine there'll be quite a bit of cosplay there.
Oh, God. Blackpool's going to be crazy, isn't it? Like Halloween, stag do's, geeks.
Ravi's got his sexy Katia costume ready to go. Nobody wants to see that. So if you're coming along to Play Expo over the weekend in Blackpool, we will see you there. If you need to get last-minute tickets, head to our website at theretrohour.com. Now, talking about Sega, what a guest we've got this week on the podcast. Al Nilsson. Now, Al was Sega of America's head of marketing. He was essentially the guy who did all those classic promotions for the Mega Drive.
Oh, yeah. So, what was it? Sonic Tuesday. Sega and all of that stuff.
Legendary system. And that was when Sega were at their peak, wasn't it?
Back it was in the Mega Drive era, wasn't it? Attitude. Yeah. And Sega were the kings of Attitude at the time.
And Al was the guy behind a lot of that. So we're going to get some fascinating stories about the inner workings of Sega back in the early 90s. And if you've read Console Wars as well, I mean, you'll kind of get to hear a lot of the stories you may have read in there kind of come to life through Al. And before that, I mean, he's got an interesting history. It wasn't just Sega that he worked at. He worked with Mattel for in television as well.
Yeah, and Tom Kalinske and guys like that, you know, because there's a big crossover between the toys and the consoles kind of world.
Yeah, a lot of the same guys worked on both, so it's really interesting. Al Nilsson, if you're a Sega fanboy, you've got to check out this week's interview. It's going to be so interesting. He's going to be our special guest on the way in around 15 minutes from now. Now, we love you guys. We appreciate you listening to this podcast every week. Because we know it takes a lot of time up, actually, you know, listening to a podcast week in, week out. But the amount of nice tweets and Facebook messages and iTunes reviews that we get of people going, I listen to every single show.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And we get a lot of people saying, I've just started listening and now I'm going through the whole back catalogue. So I think we've had people come up to us and go, I've been listening to you for 6 weeks now, every day.
Yeah, you must be sick to death of our voices after that. We do actually get a lot of that coming in. I saw one recently who said, I found your podcast a month ago. I've now caught up with every single episode in 4 weeks. And now the wait between each episode is excruciating, he said. So that is some commitment. And look, you know, we love doing this podcast. It'll be 3 years that we've been doing this in January.
Wow.
In 2 months, though. That is just crazy. And the only reason that we can keep doing it is thanks to your support. Now, there are lots of ways you can support the Retro Hour podcast. We say this all the time. If you've got a friend who's into retro gaming, Maybe tag them in one of our Facebook posts. That's always appreciated.
Yeah, or you could join the Discord server and kind of get involved with the conversation.
Yeah, you're in there all day long chatting away. I try and drop in when I can. Maybe follow us on Twitter, give us a couple little retweets, leave a review or a little thumbs up on one of our videos or episodes. That all helps. I mean, regularly we make the top 10 in iTunes, which is brilliant. Yeah, thanks to you guys. And another way that you can help out the podcast is by helping us with the running of the show as well. Now, we do have a little tip jar on the front page of our website. If you've got PayPal, you can donate via that. It takes you a couple of seconds.
Or cryptocurrencies.
Yeah, if you're into any of that, you can do all that on our website too. And really, that just helps us keep doing this podcast every week and helps out with the running of the show, which obviously, as you can imagine, doing a show week in, week out, it does have its expenses. And just for making a donation of any amount, all of which 100% goes back into the running of the show, you will get a shout in a future episode and find your place in the very prestigious Hall of Fame. Just like this week,
Paul Edwards,
Gia Tiago,
Stu Marshall, StuTube,
and Rob Burnett, who all made donations into the Running of the Retro Hour podcast. If you'd like to do the same, you can do it right now on the front page of our website at theretrohour.com. Now, before we get into Al Nilsson, this week's very special guest, we did mention it is Halloween weekend. And I imagine around this time, I don't know if anything like me, I always kind of look in Google at, like, you know, spooky video games to play on Halloween.
Yeah, yeah, I kind of get into that vibe as well. And I just have all these memories of getting absolutely scared as a kid playing Darkseid.
Yeah.
That was one. And I think just Aliens 3 on the Amiga, because they had no background music.
So very quiet.
Just like walking. That was it. And the atmosphere was just nothing.
Well, there was Alone in the Dark for me. I remember playing that quite a lot. And Alone in the Dark 2, which is actually set on Halloween, a little girl who's trick-or-treating. That's got a really good Halloween vibe
dark,
on that.
Yeah.
They were great horror games. And Ghouls and Ghosts as well. That's got a really good scary vibe to it as well.
But even the dinosaur in Lara Croft at the beginning kind of scared me quite a bit.
You're scared of anything, really.
Yeah, I was the worst.
But obviously Castlevania, they're kind of games that everyone likes to dig out on Halloween. And there is actually a little compilation that has just been released on the PlayStation 4. Now, it's a PS4 exclusive, Castlevania Requiem. Now, what it does, it's essentially a double pack combining two classic Castlevania games that you can now play on the PlayStation 4 via digital download. And one of them is Castlevania Symphony of the Night. Obviously, came out in 1997, one of the best games on the PlayStation back then. I think that is generally, whenever you see like a list of people's top 10 PS1 games, that's always in there, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And then another game that's in there that some people may not have played is Castlevania Rondo of Blood.
Which system did that come out for?
Well, that came out in 1993, and it was the prequel to Symphony of the Night. But the thing about it is, it was released on the PC Engine in 1993. And I think, if I remember correctly, it was a Japanese exclusive game at the time. So it's kind of one of those that a lot of people may not have actually played originally when it came out. It did have a couple of releases on other systems later on, but I don't think they were any good. So it's really a game that maybe most people haven't played in full quality.
That's really cool, though, because I've noticed this with a lot of retro games that kind of were published on maybe obscure systems or stuff like this. Having them released on a much bigger platform brings light to it. And, you know, it means a lot more people can enjoy it.
Well, in the West, we got Castlevania Dracula X that came out on the SNES. A couple of years later, and that took a lot of the elements from Rondo of Blood, but it's very much changed. So if you want to play this original, authentic version of it, apparently it's a bit easier than Dracula X, which was rock hard. They're going to be releasing this. It's out now, actually, so you can download it from digital download. It's released on October 26, and it'll be a PlayStation 4 exclusive as well. So if you want to get that downloaded, I'll put a link in the show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, Sir Alan Sugar, obviously a bit of a British entrepreneurial legend, is on telly now on The Apprentice, and very famous for founding Amstrad.
Yeah, and we've heard stuff like recently there was a company that were printing their festival tickets on an Amstrad, and Alan Sugar was so interested that he actually worked out how much each sheet cost.
Yeah, how much money they saved by keeping the same
computer
running.
Yeah, so I think he's still got a lot of love for the old Amstrad machines.
Well, it turns out, if you've ever watched The Apprentice, he does have an Amstrad-branded phone on his desk. So when he picks up the phone and like the receptionist sends the candidates into the room.
Right, is it an emailer?
No, it's not.
He wouldn't get that out, would he?
It is just a standard Amstrad office phone.
Okay.
Now, Alan, he's got nothing to do with Amstrad these days. You know, he sold it all to Sky a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
But he's still got love for it as well. But it turns out that apparently the BBC got a bit of an arse on with him about having that on his desk.
Well, because they probably can't, you know, the BBC is publicly funded.
Yeah.
So they can't have any kind of advertising and Alan with his Amstrad phone. It's like...
Well, that was exactly it. They essentially said to him, you can't have that there because it's product placement. Now, it turns out, because he's quite a bullshy guy, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah.
Bit of attitude on him. Apparently just came out and completely cut them down. And he said... So whose boardroom is this, yours or Sir Alan's? And what does my company make? Phones. And then he said, do you think in real life I'd have a Philips phone on my desk?
Oh,
so
yeah.
Essentially, he convinced the BBC in the early days of the Apprentice, when they had this Amstrad phone, that, you know, it wouldn't be realistic if he used anything else. He managed to keep it in there.
Well, weren't you telling me that one of the episodes is like one of these go find all of these different items, and one of them was find an Amstrad CPC?
It was last year. Yeah, one of their challenges was they had to find some like obscure items by driving all over London. And one of them was, it was kind of, I think it was tracing back Alan's history.
Yeah.
So they said, go out and find an Amstrad computer.
Go find an old barrow and some fruit. And then,
but they did actually find it, which I remember watching that, and I said to my missus, well, they can't really go on eBay because they've got to find it this afternoon. And it wasn't like a CPC 464. It was one of the more obscure Amstrad machines.
Oh, wow.
But they managed to find one. It was one of like the word processor PCWs, I think.
Oh, nice.
So there you go. Good on you, Sir Alan, standing up for Amstrad.
Yeah, totally.
Get a bit of screen time. That's always good, isn't it?
So, let's talk Spectrum next.
Yeah, well, that's kind of tied in with Amstrad. He bought them, didn't he,
yeah.
Sinclair? Now, the Spectrum next is a modern-day version of the Sinclair Spectrum.
It is, with lots of extra features in there. And it is the next step in Spectrum, isn't it? The next.
Well, we did a whole episode about it, didn't we?
Continuation, yeah. Well, the next itself is not out at the moment, but Adrian Cummins has been producing some games, and they're out at the moment. And... there's a mix. So there's a mix of digital download and physical copies. And these games look really cool. He's just talking about a new title, which is going to be coming out, which is called Montana Mike.
And now, that looks very Indiana Jones.
Yeah, it looks Indiana Jones, maybe a Rick Dangerous style-y. And there's a full collection of these games. And he's saying at the moment it's £10 for the physical release and £5 for the digital. And you're probably wondering, like, oh, there's no Spectrum next. How am I going to be able to play this
game? Well, some people have them, don't they?
Well, some people have them, yeah. But also there's C-Spect, which is the emulator.
Yeah.
So you can just run it on your PC at home anyway and then wait for that next to come out. I just think it's great that games are already being produced and there's already a little games market even before the Spectrum's arrived.
It is awesome, though, that it's kind of got this little industry popping up around it. And I love these games as well. Everything I've seen on the Spectrum Next, it just looks like kind of how you wished 8-bit games looked when you were a kid.
Yeah, how you wish they went.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you play a game and you'd be like, oh, this is great, but looking at these games, you think, if it looked like that back then, oh my God, like I probably never would have bought an Amiga or something, you know, back in the day. And there are so many people that are just tinkering with this system and making quality stuff. I mean, I think the quality of homebrew these days is so far beyond what it was back in the 80s.
Well, they're saying at the moment there's Dungeonette is available.
Yeah.
Delta Star Earth Defense, Montana Mike will be coming, and the Gold Compilation, which will be a free game pack, which will have all of those titles in.
See, to me, that is very, very nostalgic anyway, because back then you'd often get like cassette packs with like two or three games bundled in them as well.
Yeah, so. Yeah. And they're not massively expensive as well. £10 for the physical copy.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know, I would just get it anyway, because that's probably going to be a rare collector's item in the future.
And if you want like kind of games that take advantage of the next hardware, then it's a no-brainer to pick a copy of this up, isn't it? I just love seeing, like, you know, that classic Sinclair stripe and the logo on a box in 2018. It's just crazy, isn't it? Right, let's talk about vinyl video.
Yeah, vinyl video. What an idea. So this is absolutely crazy. Ever since I've been a kid, I've been wondering, floppy disks, they kind of run like this, and would there be a way to store data like on a floppy, or would there be on vinyl, or would there be a way to store some kind of information on it other than music?
Yeah.
And there was an artist who who actually created a system called Vinyl Video. And this is just mental. I'm not quite sure how it works. You can watch Techmoan's video on it, but it's fully analog.
Right.
And it will basically read, it must be like a little preamp or some kind of receiver, and then it converts the signal to either be picked up on a regular TV or through HDMI.
Wow.
And you can actually get video footage on this. If you check Techmoan's video, he's got some amazingly, it looks grainy and kind of a really low res, but the fact that he's getting video from there is just fantastic. Well, what's happened was this was an individual project before, so this was created by an artist. Now this company has actually taken up Video Vinyl, and it's probably due to some of the interest from Techmoan. And they're now selling Video Vinyl converters.
No way.
For $175. And pre-recorded editions as well come at around $17 each. And I really want to buy this because this just looks mad.
So what's the quality like then? I've not watched a video.
Oh, the quality's awful. Yeah, but, you know, it just works. It looks like a black and white, maybe one of those old kind of... cine-reel film things, right, okay, that you used to watch.
It is awesome, though. I mean, I suppose information you can put on any medium, though. Even video games used to come on cassette tapes, and, you know, vinyl is just another audio format, I guess, isn't it? You can store information in audio form.
I guess, but imagine if they had this years ago. Like, imagine if, because vinyl's been printed for a very, very long time.
Over 100 years or so, isn't it? Yeah, probably longer.
Yeah, and, you know, vinyl's fantastic, like, the whole feel of it. And we're actually involved in a bit of a vinyl project ourselves, aren't we, Dan?
You know, there's been a little trailer you may have spotted on Facebook, and a few people messaged me going, oh, have you seen you're in this thing? this little video. I'm like, yeah, we're involved in this movie. Now, this is a new film called The Vinyl Story, Keeping in the Groove.
Yeah, and so the story, you may recognise that from the guys who made the Commodore story. So it's by the same group and Wavem Studios, and they've kind of proven Kickstarter success with this film. And this one's going to be more about vinyl, the kind of vinyl revival, and stuff about, like, you know, the Jamaican sound systems, stuff about DJ scene in the kind of 90s when people were using it, and the modern revival where they're trying to make factories at the moment to print more vinyl. And it's just absolutely crazy. I never thought I'd be saying that.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading recently that, you know, in, I think it was some month last year, vinyl's actually outselling CDs in a lot of markets now.
14.3 million were sold in 2017 in the States.
Isn't it like the biggest year since like the early 90s or something? That's crazy, isn't it? What do you think it is, though? Why do you think vinyl's coming back?
I like I said in this trailer, I think it's because digital medium. Like, I personally put all my vinyls to side, downloaded everything, and then lost my collection about four or five times. So, and I've still got those vinyls that I've had since a kid, and they've still got every little nick and scratch in there that I remember from either knocking it with my mates or my mate ruining it. Or, you know, it's full of memories. That's right.
Well, I've, you know, been moving house recently, and my garage is full of my vinyl at the moment in crates. So I'm going to get set up. It's all like waterproof and everything, and damp-proof, and silicon bags in there and everything to dry up the air. But I've been going through a few of them recently, like looking through thinking, oh God, yeah, I remember when. I remember, it's weird, I remember every single place I was when either I bought it or I got given these records.
And it was when albums were a thing as well. You know, each album, I would listen to an album like probably 40 or 50 times in my whole time having it, and I'd know every lyric and know all the different bits inside the sleeve, and it was you had a lot more time, and it was a bit obsessive kind of vinyl collecting, wasn't it?
I used to go to record shops all around the country. Now I go to Birmingham, hard to find records, Black Market Records in London. I go over to Manchester.
I remember I went to a London a DJ shop, and I was like, you got any garage music? He was like, it's garage. I said garage, and we had a big argument about how to pronounce it, and I was like, garage. I think I didn't get any. I got kicked out the shop.
But I remember even going to like HMV, and they'd have like an in-store DJ playing vinyl. A mate of mine actually did it in Newcastle for a while, and their entire bottom floor was just vinyl. It was dedicated to it. So seeing vinyl back on the high street now is crazy. I love it, though.
It's nice as a consumer. As a DJ, you're probably thinking, oh, no, I've got to carry all those bags around and break my back for another few weeks.
Oh, God, I found a few of my old record bags. It was still full of vinyl, trying to get them out of the van. I was like, God, it's on the floor. It is a lot easier turning up with a USB stick these days. But I think you're right. I mean, MP3, it's disposable, isn't it?
Totally, yeah. And like stuff like, I've seen FLAC and all these lossless music players, and they're now nice devices where you can store lots of stuff on. It wasn't before. It was all burnt onto CDs and just complete madness. Yeah. All different bit rates as well.
I mean, I've got vinyl I've had for like 20 years, but I haven't got an MP3 of them.
And that's also another point, is that 320 kilobits you can pay on a huge Valve Jamaican sound system. You can't do that with a bad quality MP3.
But you can with vinyl.
But you can with vinyl, yeah.
So this movie is actually upon Kickstarter at the moment. So if you enjoyed the Commodore Story movie by Wavem Studios, give this a backing. I'm sure you're going to find it really interesting. It's got about a month to go at the moment at the time the show comes out. It's working out the difference because we're recording a bit early. So if you want to back it, I'll put a link in the show notes at theretrohour.com. We're going to be in the film as well. And maybe Ravi will have one of his vinyl video players in there by the time the movie gets out.
Have you seen the cases as well? They're like little vinyls, the CDs are.
Oh, how cute. So I'm going to get a link to that in the Kickstarter. Will be in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, before we get into our chat with Al Nilsson, all about the glory days of Sega, this is quite a cool video that 8-Bit Guy was doing, converting an old TV to RGB.
Yeah, this is another amazingly cool channel on YouTube. I think Techmoan and 8-Bit Guy are just fabulous.
We've had 8-Bit Guy on before, haven't we?
Yeah. And this is a thing that we didn't have to do that much in Europe because we had the luxury of SCART.
Yeah.
But this is a kind of RGB hack on a normal television. So he's coming directly out of the red, green and blue.
So this is on no CRT?
Yeah.
Because in America, you're right, they didn't have SCART over there. So essentially it was either composite or it was RF.
Yeah. And, you know, or S-Video maybe.
Yeah. But I think a lot of these old TVs, you're looking at this one here, all it had on it was RF.
Yeah. God, I wouldn't know what it would be like to be in that situation. We were quite in luxury here with SCART, weren't we?
Well, I used RF probably on some of my early systems. Like my brother had a Mega Drive that we ran off RF, I remember. My Amiga 500, actually, I had that stupid modulator that went on the back of it. I used that for ages, and I think that was actually the first thing that ever broke on my Amiga. I got my A500 Plus for Christmas, and that had broken by about end of December or something. I had to take it back to Dixon's. But, like you said, we didn't have to do this in the UK. But if you are in America and you want a good way of essentially getting a really clear RGB signal from your old systems, this is a great little mod that you can do on a CRT TV. Now, what I would say is, watch the video and get someone who's qualified to actually open and work on CRTs.
Yeah, that was a scary point where he has to discharge it. Yeah. But I think this is cool. I don't quite know if it would be worth it. Like, the picture comparisons, they look quite good, but I think you'd probably be better off getting, like, a multi-sync monitor or a PVM. Or something like that. But if you haven't got the luxury of doing that, I think this is a cool little hack. And I reckon if a lot more people knew about this in America back in the days, they would have had a much crisper picture.
Well, essentially what he's doing is opening up this, hacking in straight to the electron guns for RGB and then putting ports on the back of the TV, which is cool. Because the thing about it is at the moment, I mean, CRT TVs are becoming harder and harder to find. I was chatting to a guy I work with, one of the engineers at work, and he's into retro gaming as well. And he said to me the other day, he said, we had a couple of those Sony PVM monitors, you know, threw them out about 10 years ago. And now I'm thinking, oh, I wish I could.
About a year and a half ago, I had a CRT panic when I realised the prices were going up. And I was like, damn, CRT. So I managed to fill my cupboard with cheap CRTs, all multi-sync monitors. So I'm happy with my supply now, and I can fry my eyes out.
Because we've been talking about it on the podcast, you know, since we started. I mean, I've been an advocate of using CRT again for, God, when did I first bring my CRT monitor back to my flat in Nottingham? It was probably about maybe 8-9 years ago now.
Yeah.
And I did a video on YouTube probably around 2010, 2011, saying, is CRT better for retro gaming? And at the time, I got slated by so many people. I had a load of thumbs downs. People go, why would you bother doing that? You know, it looks fine on my 50-inch like plasma. Until you actually see it again and what it looked like on a CRT.
Yeah.
Because you look at it and you think, that's the way I remember these games looking.
But that's it, like, and multi-sync as well. Like, it's amazing. If you watch some of the Copper demos, Copper Master on the Amiga,
yeah,
or even just a Starfield going across on a multi-sync monitor, it looks so clearer than anything.
And you haven't got the input lag and all that and the ghosting, yeah, that you get with more modern TVs. I mean, modern TVs have like game mode, which can help a bit with the old consoles.
But I've also noticed, you're right, with YouTube, there wasn't many people doing that. And now everybody's doing a video of my new PVM.
Yeah. And I look on like, you know, retro gaming forums and like, you know, some of them are into like, you know, 700-800 pages, like show us your CRTs. And...
Yeah, yeah. But also I do remember my dad having beautiful CRTs outside and me like, let's smash them with an hammer.
Yeah. You couldn't give them away 10 years ago, could you? But that's the thing. I mean, I wonder if it will get to the stage where maybe a new factory opens somewhere in the world and kind of...
Does new tubes maybe.
Yeah. I mean, there's got to be a stage where supply and demand kind of... You know, the demand for them outweighs the supply.
Well, also, in the art world as well, if anybody wants to display an original piece of art, they need to show it in that original format.
Yeah.
So having CRTs to show VHS work and stuff is also essential.
Well, you know, because you think, like, when HDTVs came around, I got my first HDTV in around 2006, probably.
Yeah.
And you couldn't wait to get rid of your CRTs and stuff then.
But I want one now as well for... light guns.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking in my new man den, I thought, well, I've got like a little 14-inch Philips CRT. I've got a 19-inch kind of Mitsubishi Trinitron display for like my, you know, PC and sort of my old Windows 98 PC and my Amiga 4000. I thought actually I could get a little TV stand in the corner, have a nice big 28-inch nice TV for like the SNES and the Mega Drive and all that, you know, CRT.
We need a CRT factory. We need to start it, Dan.
Get on Kickstarter. Get it set up. So if you do want to find out more about connecting your old consoles to RGB, if you haven't got SCART, if you haven't got that luxury, obviously make sure you get someone qualified to do it. Don't go opening your old CRTs without professional advice. We'll link that and everything else that we've talked about in this week's show notes on our website at theretrohour.com. Right then, if you are coming to Play Expo in Blackpool this weekend, we will see you there. Don't be too hungover, Ravi, when I turn up on Sunday, please.
If you could find me.
In a bush outside the Norbert Castle.
Top of the tower. Like Godzilla.
King of the castle. So we'll see you there this weekend if you are coming down. If you're not, we'll be recording all the panels. We'll put them on YouTube. You'll hear Jeff Minter in a future episode of the podcast as well. Got to record Jeff while we're there too. So we'll see you there if you're coming down. If not, we'll check you out next Friday. And right now, let's talk all about Sega with this week's special guest, Al Nilsson. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time for the main event. We've been so excited for this. Let's welcome on our special guest, Sega legend Al Nilsson. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Great to be with you.
Now, before we get into stories of Sega and Intellivision, we need to talk about them as well. Where did this kind of journey with video games all begin for you? I mean, do you remember when you first encountered them?
First video game I ever owned was a dedicated Atari console, which had Pong and Breakout in it and maybe Circus Atari. So that was the first one that I owned. Later got a 2600, even had an Atari, whatever that music, color music thing was that it had. After college, I ended up working for JCPenney as a buyer for all of their stores and catalogs, buying video games and home computers, among other things. And took them to be the largest video game retailer in the U.S., selling Atari, Intellivision, ColecoVision, the TI-99/4A computer, the Atari 400 and 800 computers. So that got me really started on my career.
So when you initially joined JCPenney, were you interested in just the retail world, or you were interested in these kind of new technology and new products?
I was a new technology guy. So I was interested in that, and I wanted to become a marketer, but coming right out of school and going into marketing was a big jump. And so I felt that I could go into retailing, then make the jump over to marketing, which I did.
When you're working at JCPenney, I mean, what kind of games stick in your head from that time that were like big successes for you?
Well, our biggest success, we were the largest retailer of Pac-Man, and we did a special launch of Pac-Man. We had it on sale in all of our stores before everybody else. We worked closely with Atari to go and get it out. We were the first video game retailer which went on the air with a TV commercial once again for Pac-Man. If you search YouTube, you can see the ad. So that was there. You know, Space Invaders was big. The Intellivision sports games, ColecoVision, just because it was so new, you know, and then came Adam from Coleco. So it was an interesting thing. And then also just the start of, you know, the home computer business.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Pac-Man there, because I know on the Atari 2600, that version of Pac-Man, I mean, Miss Pac-Man was very good, but I know a lot of people kind of slate that game online these days. But I think people often forget probably what a big deal it was for people to be able to play Pac-Man at home.
And that was the thing. It's interesting reading people talking about it now, saying, you know, oh, there were tons of returns. No, there really weren't tons of returns. People wanted to play Pac-Man. And just because it was the flashing version of Pac-Man, they didn't mind, because they wanted to go and play Pac-Man. It was just, it resonated so well with people of all ages, men, women, boys, girls. It really was a game that the whole family could go and get into. That and Space Invaders were the two games which really helped to define video gaming. Space Invaders got a lot of games out of the closet that had been put on the side, and Pac-Man was another game that had done the same thing.
You work with Mattel as well, promoting the Intellivision.
Absolutely. You know, we liked the Intellivision, and, you know, thought it was a superior system in terms of graphics, though they had, of course, the much higher price point. But, you know, for the people who could afford it, it really was a great experience. It was also, the sports games were just so much better, which kind of, you know, replicated what we saw later on the Genesis with, you know, Joe Montana football and John Madden football and NHL hockey and all of those games, which really helped to go and bring in a whole new audience.
Well, how did you approach promoting the Intellivision up against Atari at the time?
The promotion was, we had in-store displays for both of them so people could come and play them and compare and show what they wanted. Our advertising on Intellivision was primarily newspaper. The only TV we had done was for Pac-Man. And we relied very much on the manufacturers to go and do the promotions. You know, the Intellivision had a very famous George Plimpton ads where they would go, where he would go and compare, you know, a game on Intellivision and a game on the Atari 2600, and show how much better the graphics were. The other thing that was important for us and what made us a leader or the leader, we were going to go and be the ones who had the games first. And we worked very closely with our distribution department to expedite the games into retail. If you know, today you're very, very used to games all coming out on a certain day, which is something we pioneered, you know, with Sonic Tuesday.
Yeah.
But back then, the games would come out, you know, any time over a one-month period. The stores that were the closest to the warehouse got them first. The stores that were furthest from the warehouse got them last. And so it was hard to go and do advertising based upon something that might not be in stock in the local store. So we worked very closely with the JCPenney Distribution Center to figure out how to bypass our warehouses and get the stuff into the stores within about 3 days of each other.
Did you work with Tom Kalinske at all at Mattel?
You know, I knew Tom, and I had met him once at a consumer electronics show, but did not really work with him until I got to Mattel. Once again, he was president of the toy company. He was, you know, overseeing everything that was happening in the toy company, but also, you know, keeping a watchful eye on what we were doing on the electronics business, because he had been part of the group that had started our electronics business within the Mattel toy company. And so, you know, we just got to know each other back then. But the time when we really worked side by side was at Sega.
Well, around that time, I mean, we had the 1983 North American video game crash. I mean, did that really affect things? And what was it like going through that?
You know, it was a very strange time when, you know, this beloved form of entertainment just started imploding, you know, and the major problem was some really, really terrible games coming in from third parties as well as from unofficial third parties, which were, you know, really garbage because games started not selling at all. Games were being discounted so that you could go and nobody would want them even at a lower price. You know, on my wall of my office, I have an Atari ET cartridge where it has a price sticker from $49.95 with five markdown stickers to $1.99.
Wow.
And I got it for 50% off the lowest cost. So it only cost me 99 cents. So it just shows how good a shopper I am. and so it was very strange because no retailers wanted the video game business because to them it just meant further losses. You know, the companies were, you know, also hemorrhaging money. You know, I still remember going to the Consumer Electronics Show in, I guess it was 1985, when there was this company called Nintendo, which said they wanted to get back into the video game business. And it was like, is this too soon? Are the retailers ready to go and do it again?
Well, after the crash, Nintendo became a huge success and had a huge share of the market. Could you tell the difference between Nintendo and the other companies? And did this worry a lot of retailers?
You know, what they did well was, you know, they did a test in New York with Toys R Us to go and see if, and maybe one other city, to see, you know, is there a market there? And rather than try to go, you know, and go nationwide. And it proved a success, and, you know, Toys R Us expanded to other markets. Nintendo expanded to other retailers. So that they went in and helped to prove that, you know, the market wasn't dead. It just kind of went away for a little bit because of the retailers pulling back and the manufacturers pulling back. You know, so that was there. And I think that, you know, it was similar for Sega outside of the U.S., Sega established a beachhead before Nintendo did.
Well, when did Sega first come onto your radar?
Well, I knew Sega from the arcade business and, you know, the great arcade games that they had. So that's when they first came onto my radar. From a career standpoint, they first came onto my radar in the fall of 1988 when I got a call from a headhunter who was looking for somebody to head up marketing at Sega with a new video game system. And so I was brought in and they actually videotaped my interview and sent the videotapes to Japan for them to go and look at. Simultaneously, while they were going and looking for somebody to head of marketing, they were also deciding whether or not they wanted to get back into the video game business themselves. The Sega Master System was being sold in the U.S. by Tonka Toys. Sega wasn't, you know, very happy with what Tonka was doing. They thought they could be more aggressive, but they had not made a decision yet of whether to go and partner with another company to sell and market the product or to control their own destiny. And so part of what I had to do from a job standpoint or a job hiring standpoint was actually prepare a presentation as to why Sega should go and market the new system in the U.S. under their own name. So I had to go and prove to them that there was a market in order for myself to get a job.
Well, joining around that time in the late 80s, I mean, that must have been a very exciting time to join Sega. Did you feel like you were kind of on the crest of something really big?
I and my colleagues didn't think that, you know, we did not envision taking over Nintendo in terms of market share. But what we thought was that we could go and become a strong second player and be profitable, you know, kind of like the Intellivision to the Atari 2600. And it was also a very small group. There was only about five of us back then. along as well as with some about 15 game counselors who answered calls and gave game hints and tips, and a small little repair shop that repaired master systems. So it was, you know, really a startup back then. So it was an interesting time, but, you know, did we have any thoughts that, you know, we could go and be number one? Because Nintendo just was so strong in the U.S. at the time.
When did you first see the Genesis then, and what were your kind of thoughts around it?
First time I saw the Genesis or the Mega Drive was during my first interview when I went in to meet with one of the technical people who had a Genesis there. And my interview was, he sat me in front of the unit, turned it on and said, go play. And it was Altered Beast. And I guess I did a good enough job because he went and said, good, thank you very much. And the interview was over. So it was one of the stranger interviews I've ever had in my life. You know, love the graphics, love the sound, you know, very close to the Sega arcade. And you know, I definitely could tell, you know, the difference between that and a Nintendo Entertainment System.
I mean, you mentioned there about the Mega Drive Genesis difference. I mean, the naming, that was a copyright reason, wasn't it, that it couldn't be called Mega Drive in North America?
Right. It was a trademark reason, and someone owned the trademark in the category that we would be covering, the trademark category that the system would be under. So we had to go and look at new things, and that was actually the first thing that I did when I joined Sega. They had six names that they liked. One was Genesis, one was Cyclone, another one had a icon of a fox, and I don't remember what its name was, nor the other three. And we had mocked up front covers of the hardware boxes that looked, you know, just like the Genesis box looked just like what the final box was. And I had to go out and do some market research and talk to consumers and find out what they preferred and why they preferred it. Internally, we loved Genesis the most, and consumers agreed. They you know, said, yes, I get that, you know, Genesis in the Bible, you know, a new beginning. But they also got the Genesis project from the Star Trek movies. And so once we had a name, we were off and running.
I guess there was the band Genesis as well.
Phil Collins.
Yeah. kind of initially, the main competitor, the 16-bit competitor, was the TurboGrafx-16. Was it seen as much of a threat mm-hmm. at the time?
we didn't see it as much a competitor. They had been, you know, it had been around for a couple of years. They had been shopping it to a lot of different people, including companies. One company that I had been working with, Hasbro. And so I knew about it and you know, the games that they had. But they had a lot of money, and we didn't have a lot of money. Nintendo had a huge amount of money. And, you know, one of my favorite memories is we took some of the largest retailers down to the Pebble Beach Golf Resort to show them what we were planning on doing, introducing Genesis, so let them play some golf. And we had five games. I had been on board for about a month and a half. So I had some packaging and a marketing plan. And that was about it. And went through it. And one retailer, major retailer, goes and says, I like what you're doing, but, you know, TurboGrafx is going to eat your lunch. I'll take you guys, but I'm going to return everything on December 26th that doesn't sell. Because NEC, you know, they're just so great. They've got this video and they've got this fancy brochure. That's how you decide, you know, what's the better product. And so our head of sales says, but you'll still carry us, won't you? And they said, yeah, but, you know, I'm going to return you. That's fine. Just carry us. And, you know, the best part about it was on December 26th, it was NEC that got returned. we had close to an 80% market share by the end of 1989. And NEC had lost a lot of their retail partners. And so they weren't doing a lot. And so it was, they were a relatively easy threat to do away with. And then once we got, them out of the way, it was time to go after Nintendo.
Well, Sega had some, great kind of strap lines and marketing strategies and a lot of kind of marketing talk as well. I mean, where did blast processing come from and what did it really mean?
Well, blast processing was something that was 1992, 1993. It was one of our latest things. We were looking for something that we could go after because Nintendo was making a lot of headway with Mode 7 processing. Mm-hmm. And we were looking for what could we go and do. And we brought our engineers and our software developers in to go and say, we proved with Sonic that we were, the fastest system and we were able to deliver great graphics. How can we, what really makes that work? So there were, it's this technical thing here and this technical thing there. It wasn't just like one chip. And it wasn't just like, one thing like Mode 7 was. It was a bunch of things. And in the discussion, someone came up with the term blast processing. We were able to describe what we were doing with blast processing and then did a great TV ad showing this great race car with Sonic on the back of it playing, racing against an old milk truck with a Mario TV strapped on the back of it. And it really helped show the difference between the two.
The fact that the Genesis was like an arcade experience always came along across well. Was that like intentional? Because especially in the UK, I remember we used to have lots of old computers and getting an arcade-style console was just an amazing thing.
Well, when we launched Genesis at the June 1989 Consumer Electronics Show, we had this giant arcade machine. Imagine an arcade machine 15 feet high. You were seeing the great Sega arcade games being played on it, and with this soundtrack, and all of a sudden the arcade machine split in two and opened up, and there was a Sega Genesis system with a TV set showing that we were bringing the arcade heritage home. We also gave out arcade tokens with the face of Tommy Lasorda from our Tommy Lasorda baseball game. And that's one of the rarer Sega souvenirs, 1989.
Well, we talked about blast processing. I mean, what's the kind of a conscious effort to make the Genesis appear much more grown up and cooler than Nintendo's offering?
Our plan from day one, when we looked at the Nintendo audience, was primarily 6 to 12-year-old boys. Mm-hmm. And Nintendo acknowledged that's who was playing it. Our goal was to make the 8-bit Nintendo system be like a toy. And, okay, now that you're done with your toys, it's time to, grow up and use, this new cool system. And everything that we did was to go and, reiterate the coolness of Sega and the uncoolness of Nintendo. And so, and then also introduce, these great sports games, which appeal to college students and young adults. We got teenagers in. The arcade version, the number one players in arcades were teenagers. And by bringing the arcade experience home, we were bringing teenagers into the video game business. And then our marketing, first starting in 1990, and the 16-bit Nintendo still hadn't been introduced at the time, was to compare ourselves against the 8-bit Nintendo. And we did the campaign, Genesis Does What Nintendo Don't. And that became a major point of differentiation between the two and split people into the 8-bit camps and the 16-bit camps, 8-bit camps and the Genesis 16-bit camps. We continued Super NES was getting launched and coming out in August, September of 1991, being the nice person that I am, I launched it for them, where we did mall tours around the country, where we let people play the 16-bit Super Mario, which we had gotten in Japan, and this hedgehog guy named Sonic. And we let them play them both head-to-head and then vote for which one they preferred. Sonic was winning by 85% plus, and the highest preference for Sonic over Mario was in Nintendo's backyard in Seattle, Washington, 5 miles from the mall was 5 miles from their headquarters. So once again, we wanted to go and show we were the best and we were the coolest. Then we came up with the great ad campaign, Welcome to the Next Level, which really redefined what video game advertising looked like and really helped to go and make Sega by far the coolest system out there.
But when you're doing this marketing, like, you know, Genesis does what Nintendo don't, I mean, you really went for the jugular there by directly naming Nintendo. Did that ever cause any problems with that upper management? And did you ever find out what Nintendo thought of that?
Well, Nintendo, there was no love lost between Sega and Nintendo. You know, if you read Console Wars, you know, people go Console Wars, you know, what is that? You know, Microsoft versus PlayStation. Well, this was really kind of a war between the two. We didn't like each other and we would do whatever is best. And we felt that it was important at the time to go for their jugular because we had something that was superior. You know, our 16-bit system was way superior than their 8-bit system. And then when our 16-bit system came out and theirs came out, you know, we had, you know, the fastest video game character around, Sonic, as well as these great sports games and everything else. And so we wanted to go and show it that we were the cool system that was out there. So Sega, Nintendo did not like our advertising. They especially did not like our advertising where we compared Game Gear or Game Boy, excuse me, their Game Boy, to a dog. because dogs are colorblind and therefore they would choose Game Gear. As opposed to Game Boy, as opposed to the grid color of Game Gear. That Nintendo did not like at all. Sega Japan management did not like our naming names because it was something that just wasn't culturally done in Japan. But it worked in the U.S. And, you know, in 1992, we had a 65% market share.
Where did the idea of the Sega Scream come from?
The idea from the Sega Scream came from the advertising agency, Good Beaverland and Silverstein. We were looking for a new ad agency. They did a lot of research into things, and they had these wild ads with lots of video cuts between them. And they wanted something that could go and be cool in one of the ads. And so they got this guy who went into a recording studio, and the guy was a friend of one of the ad agency people, and he was really, really sick, but he managed to get into the recording studio for about 3 or 4 hours, just screamed the word Sega. and they found the one Sega that they liked, and it became the Sega Scream.
I bet he had a sell for it after that.
Yeah, he gets royalties. That was the part of the Welcome to the Next Level campaign.
Well, when Sonic came along, that must have been a real blessing. How did you approach marketing him?
First of all, we kept it very quiet. It was kind of on a need-to-know basis within Sega all over. You know, we said this can go and be our secret weapon against the launch of the Super NES. And so we don't want anybody to go and show this to anyone or even hint that it's coming about so that we can go and just kind of pull it out at the last minute. Sega Japan wanted to go and show it at the Tokyo Game Show. Finally, after a lot of pressure, they were able to go and show the title screen where Sonic comes out through the logo and swags his finger in the air. So we wanted to go at the introduce Sonic at the Consumer Electronics Show in June of 1991, which was when Super NES was going to go and be introduced. And Nintendo thought that, you know, once Super NES was introduced, Sega would just go away because now they had a 16-bit system, and that was great. But what we did, we went and did something very interesting. Within our booth, we had two giant monitors, one on top of each other, and one was playing Super Mario World from Super NES, and the other was playing this Sonic the Hedgehog. We asked people to choose which one they thought was the best. We didn't do the voting there. We did the voting later on with consumers, but these were with the buyers and with the press. You know, Sonic was so speedy. Sonic, the graphics were just so superior and so colorful. You know, I remember one member of the press who had just attended a Nintendo press conference where they introduced Super NES. And he comes up to me and without taking a breath says, Super Nintendo has 32,568 colors and you only have 512. What are you going to do about it? And I think I was probably not as fast as he said it. I walk him over to the wall where we had Sonic and Mario. And I said, which one has 32,000 colors? I said, it's not how many colors you have. It's what you do with them. And he just kind of skulked away. We had done, you know, some secret play tests around the country where we have kids who were heavily Mario lovers. They had to go and say that Nintendo was their favorite game system and Mario was one of their top five games. We asked them to play Super Mario World and then to play Sonic. And they had not seen any of them because they had never seen the 16-bit system because it was only out in Japan. They had never seen Sonic because that wasn't out. 88% of those people in that playtest, hardcore, diehard Nintendo and Mario fans, chose Sonic as the game that was there. And so we decided that that was our leader, and to go and do everything that we can to go and compare Sonic and Mario, and just to get the world to see what this great video game character was. And you have to remember, in the U.S., we didn't know what hedgehogs were. We didn't have hedgehogs. We had groundhogs. And it's kind of like, what's a hedgehog? What's a blue hedgehog? The answer was the fastest thing in video gaming.
Well, one day that will always stick in my memory, November 24th, 1992. I remember the build-up in magazines, TV shows, to Sonic Tuesday. Now, that was when Sonic the Hedgehog 2 came out, and it was the first time that I really remember hearing about such a big official release date for a video game. Where did that idea come from, and how did that campaign come about?
It really came about as something very, very last minute. Madeline Schroeder, who is the product manager on Sonic, and I were working on the marketing plan, the launch of Sonic 2. And we had been working on it for about 3 months, getting co-promotional partners in, and we had to present it to the senior staff at Sega, Tom Kalinske and company. The next morning, we had all of, you know, everything together. We were rehearsing it. There was no PowerPoint at that time, so there were, you know, overhead projectors. So we went through this. It was a fabulous plan. But as I kept looking at it, I'm going, this isn't good enough. It's not big enough. And you know, Madeline was crazy. It's like it's the biggest video game promotion that's ever been done. And I'm going, no, I just don't like it. You know, we need to do better. We just kept going back and forth. It's like, you know, are you crazy? What else is there? I don't know where it came from. Out of the blue, I come from, we're going to go and do a street date. We're going to go and all the product will be delivered by air freight to the retailers the day before. We're going to make it a global street date. And it was like, okay, that's a plan. And so we went to work and we had to rewrite everything to go and do that, to present, you know, the following morning. The reason why there hadn't been a street date before was if you shipped product to a retailer, whenever they get it, they put it on sale. Even if it said, you know, hold for July 6th. Well, if they got it July 1st, they put it on sale. They put it on sale. The guy down the block's going to put it on sale. And so all of your street date activities went out the window. And so the only way we could get around that was by air freighting the orders directly to each store instead of a warehouse and have them arrive the day before Sonic Tuesday, which cost a lot of money, but it was well worth the expense. After I presented that to my fellow members of senior staff, it immediately was, yeah, we got to go and do it. And Tom says, I'll call Nick Alexander, who is the head of Sega Europe. Shinobu Toyo said, I'll call Nakayama-san, who is the head of Sega. By that evening, we had the rest of the world on board. And then we had group meetings to go and say, you know, here's what we're doing. Let's go. Are there good ideas we can share? Is there artwork that we can go and share? But we don't want to go and have one size fits all. We want you to do whatever is right for your market. Then we did a video news release where we had the crowds waiting for Sonic in Japan. We had the hot air balloons and buses that were being done in the UK and in France. And then finally the launch in the US that we sent all over the world. It just became a phenomenon in the video game industry, and it's how video games are sold today.
Well, we've had Tom Kalinske on the show before, and he's often talked about a kind of difficult relationship with Sega Japan. How did you find the relationship between the US and Sega Japan?
You know, it all depended on what group you were dealing with. I had a very, very good relationship with the product development group. I would be in Japan every month and a half, and I would be sitting down with all of the developers looking at the games that were in development, from whether it was just on a piece of paper to, you know, initial graphics to final gameplay. And so I had a very, very good relationship with them. There were people who, you know, were jealous of our success, we think, who, you know, it was a little strange relationship. And it got a little, you know, more strained as time went on, you know, because it's kind of like, you're the child, we're the parent. That's okay. We're providing a lot of money to the company. So it was difficult.
Well, obviously around that time, as we kind of got towards the mid-90s, CD technology became the big buzzword. And we had the Sega / Mega CD. Was that a difficult sell, being such a new technology?
You know, there's always early adopters for new technology. You know, it wasn't a huge numbers as the numbers of Mega Drives or Genesis systems, but it was still a good proportion ratio to hardware sales, and kept getting stronger as we got better and titles coming out. But it was very important for Sega because it was learning what really worked on a CD format in gaming. And so we were able to try a lot of different things to learn what were the best types of games that worked, how could we take existing games and change them for CD. So it was a kind of very important innovation lab for us.
And for developers, it must have been quite a big challenge as well, because I mean, it'll take a lot more resources to make a CD title than it would a cartridge.
Definitely, yes. But I think that once again, everyone knew that CD was the future. And it was a technology that wasn't going to go away anytime soon. And so, therefore, the developers needed to get on board to start learning and start investing in CD.
Sonic CD was a fantastic title. Was that a big system seller?
Absolutely. You know, it was the team, the Sonic team, you know, was very involved, as well as bringing in the audio resources, Spencer Nilsson did the music for the U.S. version, no relation. You know, it's kind of like, what can I go and do? What are the capabilities of the system? Which is really what the Sonic team did and what Nakasan did, you know, with the original Sonic. How can we go and really max out the capabilities of the system? How can we make Genesis do not just what Nintendo don't, but, you know, do things that hadn't even been documented yet in terms of capabilities? They were finding new capabilities. And it was the same type of thing with Sonic CD.
Well, I heard you weren't a fan of the 32X.
I was not a fan of the 32X. It was, in terms of what it was offering and the price that was there, plus we were trying to launch Sega CD simultaneously, we were confusing everybody. We were confusing the developers, okay? What should I do? Should I do Genesis? Should I do Sega CD? Should I do 32X? And we wanted people, you know, to be very focused and to be focused on Sega CD and Genesis, because there was still, you know, lots of life there. And then it was $150 peripheral. Okay, so you're spending $100 on Genesis, $150 on 32X. What was Sega CD? $200? Retailers only, consumers only had so much, you know, spending. And quite honestly, we'd rather they spend the money on software than go and buy an expensive peripheral. And a peripheral that was something, it was, you know, you'd have to go and there's a learning curve. How do you go and make it, you know, utilize all the capabilities in it? How do you go and control the two microprocessors that were in 32X? And it was, you know, from the first time Tom and I saw it, you know, at Sega R&D in Japan, it was just, we didn't feel like it was a product that had a market for it.
And you approved right later on.
Unfortunately. And I've got one with from Toys R Us with a $19 price point sticker on them. I like covering things like that, except when it was my own company.
Well, one thing I read about in Console Wars was the story of how you didn't like the initial name for Tails in Sonic 2 when he was called Miles Per Hour. You weren't a fan of that and had it change. Is that true?
Yeah, nobody liked the name Miles Per Hour. It was an interesting pun. For miles per hour, it just wasn't a great name. Miles wasn't a good name in, you know, a well-known name in the U.S., a beloved name. It didn't speak to what this character was. And we tried and tried and tried and tried to get Naka to agree to change the name to something else. And the name that we had come up with was just a simple name, but simple names are great when they go and they describe the difference. And we called him Tails because he had two tails. So very appropriate name. And Tom Kalinske tried, Shinobu Toyota tried, I tried, Madeline tried, and still no luck. And finally, Tom says, you know, why don't you guys write a backstory for why Tails is called Tails. Make it a last-ditch effort to go and see if that would happen. And so Madeline and I worked on the backstory and how Sonic met this fox and how he got the name Tails. And then Shinobu and I went down to where we had the Sonic 2 team sequestered building about 15 miles away from our main headquarters. We didn't want them to have any interference from anybody at Sega. And I read them my story, or our story, and Shinobu translated it. by the end of the story, there was actually one person who had one of the developers who had a tear in his eye. Naka-san said, you can call him Tails. So his name is Miles Prower, but his nickname is Tails. And if you want to read the full story, the exact story that we read to the Sonic team, pick up a copy of Console Wars.
So why did you end up leaving Sega in the end?
I was, based upon the success of Sonic Tuesday, it being the first global launch, there was the hope that there could be more. And so I was given global marketing responsibility. But it was a job where I was doing a lot of traveling. I was traveling about 80% of the time, flying around the world. But I wasn't being able to go and get the authority to go and work with them. You know, Sega Japan wanted to do their own thing. And so it was hard to go and replicate a success that we were doing that we did with Sonic 2. I just grew frustrated because I want to go and make things happen. And unfortunately, I had been put in a position where I couldn't go and achieve what needed to be done.
And it was kind of sad, I mean, you know, for those of us who were big fans of Sega, because it seemed like on the Mega Drive / Genesis, you did everything right, and it was such a big success. And did you kind of keep an eye on them, and did you kind of see their missteps and slow decline with the Saturn and the Dreamcast after that? And did you ever think about what you would have done differently if you were still there?
Did I think of it? Yes. Did I obsess over it? No. I kept in touch with Sega. I did some consulting work for them, for Tom and Shinobu. You know, and when Dreamcast was coming out, you know, Sega was talking to me about, did I want to come back? I just continued on doing my own thing.
Well, what are you doing today? What are you up to these days?
You know, I've been running a marketing consulting company for the last 25 years, helping companies launch products, develop products, just do business strategies. Every client's a little bit of different. Is a little different in terms of what I'm doing for them.
Well, Al, there's a couple of guys who grew up playing Sonic and Mega Drive. I mean, it's been an honor talking to you. Thank you so much for all the hard work that you and the guys did back then that gave us, you know, lasting memories for the rest of our lives.
Well, thank you. We had a fabulous team, and it was the best group of people we've ever worked with, and we're still friends to these days, and, you know, it was a unique time. So we thank you for being fans of everything that we did, and, you know, the whole current retro gaming craze, if you want to go and call it that. It's bringing us a lot of joy to go and see that people still are talking about what we did and still want to play the games that we introduced to the world. You know, once again, if you want the full story on both the Nintendo side and the Sega side, you know, pick up a copy of Blake Harris's Console Wars. It really is he spoke with close to 300 people in the industry back then to go and get a really great synopsis and tells a really good story about what happened.
Well, Al, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
My pleasure. Thanks. Have a good day.